by obviously the University Liverpool Hope University, and it's under the umbrella of the Association of Continental Philosophy of Religion, but also the University of Liverpool, Dan Whistler being representative, has funded the bulk of the expenses for Anthony Paul Smith to come and talk to us this evening. I think it's part of your doing a little tour. Doing a tour around the UK. So just to introduce Anthony today, Anthony Paul Smith is Assistant Professor in the Department of Religion at LaSalle University in the States. He's been currently working on François Laruelle's material, and actually the first person to kind of translate it and bring it into the attention, really, of an English-speaking audience. In particular, the work Future Christ, A Lesson in Heresy, that was your translation. Anthony has also got a new book entitled Laruelle, A Strange of Thoughts, and that's coming out, I believe that's with Polity Press. Okay, and if, unlike me, you're often online and engaging with various blogs and on Facebook and the like, Twitter, I don't know if you've got Twitter actually.
I do, but it's just for my id.
There you go, it's for his id. Yeah. Okay, but you've got a really well-known blog. I'm going to try and say it, my German is terrible. And für sich.
Yeah, I didn't name it.
Oh, so you didn't name it?
No,
oh,
I don't speak German either. Yeah. So.
But this is a really renowned blog for working on this kind of material in the area of continental philosophy of religion. There's a number of other people involved in the blog.
Yeah, Adam Kotzka, Daniel Barber, Bradley Johnson.
But you are a leading voice.
Beatrice Maravich.
It's a good group. So do check that out if you're not aware of it. So the seminar talk today, it's going to be around 15 minutes, and we're going to have around 30 minutes of questions. And the title of the talk is Victims Over Victors, Laruelle's Ethical Theory. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing what you have to say and hopefully making Laruelle's material a bit more accessible. But yes, take it away then.
Yeah, so let me start off by saying thank you to everyone for coming. Thanks to the Forum for European, or is it this Forum for European Philosophy? For European Philosophy. Dan for bringing me over. And the Association for Continental Philosophy and Religion, which I'm really glad is around. So basically, what I'm going to try to do is I'm basically assuming people don't have much knowledge of Laruelle. Is that fair enough to start off with? Okay, so I'll do a kind of introduction to him, and it'll start off a little bit gossipy. I'll say why, and hopefully it'll elucidate a little bit about some of his work. So I start off with a bit of biography, basically. Before I turn to a very general kind of discussion of his ethical theory, and maybe in the question and answer, if you guys want to go deeper into the technical aspects of it, we can do that. It's really up to you. So I'm basically what this is I'm finishing up an introduction to Laruelle that's going to be coming out with Polity Press called Laruelle, Stranger Thought. And the real idea behind it is to try to show how Laruelle's non-philosophy is what he calls his project, and I'll explain why in a moment, but how that actually bears on some classical areas of philosophical inquiry, like ethics and politics and metaphysics, because most of the Anglophone literature on Laruelle has been focused really on this negative moment in his work, his critique of philosophy, and it's been to the detriment of realizing what non-philosophy can do. So the kind of nucleus of this talk, I guess, or what it's really about, is the ethical chapter, the chapter on his ethics that's going to be in the book. And so this is just a section from that. Okay. So like I said, though, I'm going to start off talking about the author, Francois Laruelle. Some of you might be familiar with you. You guys met him. He just spoke in London. Was that yesterday? No, it was 2 days ago. On Monday, he gave a little public lecture at Swedenborg Hall. I think he might be the only person who's ever been invited by Kingston University who was excited to be speaking at Swedenborg Hall, because he finds Swedenborg interesting as a crazy mystic guy. And he also gave a little workshop for us at the Bloomsbury headquarters. But most of you, I'm guessing, just don't know much about him at all, and don't know much about his work. Now, the standard philosophical position from Heidegger and Deleuze is that a philosopher's biography is unimportant. I'm kind of unashamedly a bit of a gossip, and partly I'm remembering Agamben's line in his The Time That Remains, that there is a good use of gossip, and as a form of art, gossip can be closer to truth than factual adequation, which I always liked. And I personally like to know a little bit about the thinkers I spend so much time with. From a non-philosophical perspective, there's something actually really important about biography, for ethics especially. There's something important about the defense of what he calls lived experience as the determination of thought. And even the first properly non-philosophical work by Laruelle bears the title, if translated, The Biography of an Ordinary Man. So Laruelle is himself exceedingly ordinary. He has a far more working class background than others in his generation. He just celebrated his 75th birthday back in August, meaning that Laruelle belongs to the younger cadre of thinkers within the larger group known as the 68ers, the Soixante Huitards. And unlike Badou, unlike Deleuze, who in some sense, looking at their family background, you're like, yes, you're the ones who are supposed to go on to university, you're the ones who are supposed to go on to become important professors, that sort of thing. Laruelle was born into a farming family. He was born into a minority Calvinist family. And he was born in the northeast of France, quite near the German border, into this farming community. His mother actually died when he was very young. He spent most of his youth working on the family farm, herding cows and milking cows. He actually has, there's kind of like an anecdote he likes to tell, where he says he's the only philosopher since Fichte to have milked a cow. I don't know if that's true, but he claims it. So he also really likes Fichte. He also did not attend elite Parisian universities. He did manage, at some point his family just moved from the farm to Paris when he was in his early kind of teens, and he did manage to do a couple years at Henri Quatre, which some of you might know is a very difficult and prestigious lycée, or a kind of preparatory school for university, where the likes of Deleuze and others did go. But he went there, but he after he graduated from there, he took a year off, he didn't go right on to university, and he also didn't go into the elite Parisian universities. So he did his doctorate at the ENS, the École Normale Supérieure, which is normal, but he didn't do the one in Paris. He actually went and did it in Lyon, so he's always a little bit outside of the establishment. What you're supposed to do, sort of thing. In many ways, though, Laruelle has been fantastically successful, despite his, I think we can say, humble background. He spent most of his career teaching in the University of Paris system, and he achieved the rank of full professor at a relatively young age, which in the Parisian system is rather difficult. But he was always on the fringes, always a bit rebellious in ways that kept him out of the mainstream, while also being an unknown force in French and Anglophone continental philosophy. So Laruelle's had this strange subterranean influence on movements that have happened in French philosophy and in its reception in the Anglophone world. So for example, though he was always more attractive, as he likes to say, to more radical and somewhat disreputable figures in their day, like Deleuze and Derrida and Foucault, who you know, when they were writing in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, you know, weren't the accepted figures that, you know, they've come to be in our circles. Larwell actually did study, though, with Ricoeur, who was very respectable for his doctorate. The influence isn't very noticeable outside of a strong schooling in Husserl and Heidegger, but it was through this shared connection of a doctoral advisor in Ricoeur that Constantine Bondis came to actually translate Larwell, or sorry, came to translate Deleuze for the first time. So Constantine Bondis was also a student of, some of you guys might not know this name, but he's one of the first translators and commentators on Deleuze in the English-speaking world, and he went to Paris to study with Ricoeur. It was after staying and working alongside of Larwell and his spouse, an epistemologist named Anne-Françoise Schmid, that Bondis actually decided to switch from studying phenomenology for his doctorate to studying Deleuze, which again led to this this work on Deleuze. And this is talked about actually in the Deleuze and Guattari biography, which has been translated into English a couple years back. Bondis is talking about it and explicitly credits Larwell with this. Larwell is also credited by Bernard Stiegler with introducing Stiegler to the work of Simondon, who's another kind of important influence on Merleau-Ponty and Deleuze and others, leading Stiegler to pursue the republication of Simondon's out-of-print works in French. So Stiegler is instrumental in bringing Simondon back into the discussion in French philosophy, and it's he credits in the little front piece, introduction to those republished works of Simondon, he credits Larwell with introducing him and encouraging him to do this. Now, Larwell is in many ways rebellious within the French philosophical establishment, and he has been since the beginning of his career. Prior to pursuing his own project of non-philosophy, he wrote highly original works, more akin to the kind of secondary readings that we're used to in continental philosophy. Including here is a work on the aesthetics and ontology of Philippe Ravissant, a work of political philosophy, critiquing the disparate work of Heidegger, and the Nouveau Philosophes, using Nietzsche, so the new philosophers who include amongst their ranks BHL, the guy who likes to wear a shirt down to his belly button, and, encouraged the French to intervene in Libya, a kind of neoliberal figure. He wrote a book critiquing them, had public debates with some of the new philosophers, but he used Nietzsche to do this. As well as during this period of his life writing some of the first serious books in French on Derrida and deconstruction. This reading of Derrida carried out over a few books probably deserves more attention than it's received. And even within the world of Derrida scholarship, a figure as respected as Leonard Lawler credits Larwell with inspiring part of his influential study of Husserl and Derrida. So in that Husserl and Derrida book by Leonard Lawler, if you guys know it, there's a whole chapter that he, in the beginning footnote, says that the majority of this argument is essentially inspired by philosophies of difference, the book that came out just last year in English translation as well. Now, this reading of Derrida by Larwell also prefigures some of the fashionable materialist, so-called materialist readings of Derrida you see in someone like Martin Hoglund, and you can probably tell that just by the title of one of these books, which in English, again, would be Textual Machines. So Deleuze, early on in his reading of Derrida, began to read Derrida using tools he pulled actually from Deleuze. So kind of using Deleuze as a frame, he began to read Derrida's work as this materialist philosophy. Okay, now all of this led to Larwell finding a new fringe, a new margin to live on, tenuous though it was, to live on the fringe of an already existing margin. And of course, it wasn't meant to last. How could one continue to subsist on the fringe of a margin? Larwell began to develop his critique of philosophy actually in the early 80s, and this culminates in his 1986 book that I already mentioned that was recently translated into English by Rocco Gangl, Philosophies of Difference. And in that book, what he tries to do is find what he calls the invariant core of contemporary philosophies, and he does that by looking at Nietzsche and Deleuze and Heidegger and Derrida. This critique, which essentially made the claim that Derrida's deconstruction could be understood as a philosophy amongst others, as expressing the invariant structure that identifies philosophy as such, ultimately led to a heated exchange between the two thinkers in the late 80s, where Derrida actually accused Laruelle of being a terrorist within philosophy, perpetuating a socio-philosophical war, which, of course, Laruelle took some offense at. Now, obviously, I wasn't there. I think I was 8 when this happened. But the transcript of this debate was published in a journal that Laruelle edited for a number of years called La Décision Philosophique. And it's a translation of it has been floating around the internet for a number of years in a few different translations. And it's actually just been published in a collection of essays by Laruelle that Telos Press published. I'm not entirely sure why Telos Press published this. It's not really in line with their Carl Schmitt obsession. But I honestly think that the editor was told that Laruelle works on decision, and Telos thought that that worked. But you can get this interview there, and it's translated by Robin McKay, actually. Now, reading that transcript, the whole thing kind of reminded me of an anti-drugs commercial that you guys might not have had in the UK, but maybe you'll know about it. And I remember it because it sticks in my head from when I was a kid in the 80s, where the scene is essentially this father with a great 80s mustache shows up and he confronts his child with a box of drugs. I mean, literally, it's a box of drugs. That it's just indiscriminate generic drugs. And he demands to know from his son where he learned how to do this from. And the child responds in an overdramatic manner, "You, Dad, I learned it from watching you." And the lesson being, as the serious voiceover tells us, that children of parents who do drugs end up doing drugs themselves. And indeed, when Derrida accuses Laruelle of playing a game for which only Laruelle appears to know the rules, of critiquing philosophy for its bad habits and dancing away from counterblows, Laruelle indeed does tell Derrida that he learned from Derrida's works how to read this defensiveness within what Laruelle calls philosophical sufficiency or philosophical pretension. Okay, so what is this this Laruellian philosophy, this post-deconstruction, post-phenomenological, post-difference philosophy that Laruelle has constructed? Well, first I should say that the posts here are a kind of joke. They certainly aren't doing much work other than explaining that Laruelle's philosophy comes after these and has been heavily influenced by them. As you are likely familiar, if you Googled Laruelle after seeing the title of the talk, Laruelle comes to call this project of his non-philosophy, and it's a little hyphen, non-philosophy. To get a grip on what this might mean, let's be clear about what it is not. Non-philosophy does not designate some outside of philosophy, an external, internal condition of philosophical activity, nor does it designate an anti-philosophy. Okay, with regards to this first one, the outside of philosophy, Laruelle writes in Principles of Non-Philosophy, which is coming out in translation next spring. He writes there, "Each philosophy defines, then, a non-philosophical margin that it tolerates, circumscribes, reappropriate, or what it uses in order to expropriate itself, as beyond or other to philosophical mastery. So its concern is with a non whose content and means of action are ontic or empirical, ontological in the best cases, but whose reach is limited by this mastery," end quote. Okay. What he's talking about here is those non-philosophies that standard philosophy has always appealed to. So you have this in people like Deleuze, you have this in Heidegger, when they appeal to things like biology in Deleuze, for example, or they appeal to poetry in Heidegger. Or even currently with Badiou, where they, you know, he appeals obviously to mathematics. These sorts of non-philosophies are the kinds of region that regions that standard philosophy plays with, but always as the cat plays with the mouse. So non-philosophy simply means there that the unthinking forms of interaction are naive thought in the everyday world. For the standard philosophy, what non-philosophy means for them is just this. Just these things that other people who aren't thinking very deeply do. You know, science does not think, the famous Heidegger quote. And, of course, you know, he goes on to nuance that. But you know, science does not think. The poet doesn't, this is, you know, Socrates talking about artists. And we've maybe all felt this at art installations when artists are talking about their own work. We're like, well, I could have done that a little bit better. But, you know, this sort of notion of, like, the philosopher can speak for the people who can do things in a naive, everyday sense. Okay. So, concerning the second one, anti-philosophy, Laruelle is quite clear that non-philosophy is not, as he says, the mass negation of philosophy. The non here takes its cue from or models itself on the sciences, namely non-Euclidean geometry. As most of you likely, or as many of you probably will know, maybe better than I do, non-Euclidean geometry did not replace Euclidean geometry. It wasn't an anti-Euclidean form of geometry, but had instead a twofold relationship with standard Euclidean geometry. First, it changed the axioms by which Euclidean geometry worked. Euclid's geometry is based on five axioms, and to do a non-Euclidean form, one of these axioms, related to the infinitude of parallel lines, is negated, giving a different foundation for mathematical works that is able to solve problems that Euclidean geometry could not, namely to do with hyperbolic geometry, curved lines, and the like. Now again, this changing of the axiom didn't replace Euclidean geometry. That sort of a vision of a single discourse on the universe given to us by peddlers of popular science and big science rarely matches up with how actual scientific research programs do their work. In fact, it goes so far in not replacing standard Euclidean geometry that allowed for a renewed understanding of Euclidean geometry and new variations of its standard operations. So, in short, non-Euclidean geometry and Euclidean geometry are both useful. In some ways, they're useful together, in other ways, they're useful separate from one another. Now, this pretty closely mirrors what's going on in the name non-philosophy, and the relationship between standard philosophy and Laruelle's attempt at what he sometimes calls a non-standard philosophy. Of course, philosophy doesn't have a single figure that has set down its axioms. But in European philosophy, since Plato, it seems reasonable to claim that there is a near-universal grounding of all systems in being or the other in some form or another. So being or the other. With this in mind, I think we can see that Laruelle's change in axiom is also somewhat analogous to the change from Euclidean to non-Euclidean geometry. In standard Euclidean geometry, the parallel postulate maintains that one and only one line can be drawn through any point not on a given line parallel to the given line in a plane, basically meaning that lines would be parallel if the sum of their angles added up to 180 degrees. What non-Euclidean geometry was able to do by suspending this axiom and negating it in various ways was open up the understanding of space to include relativity in overly simple terms. More than one line, or no line at all, could be drawn through a single point. In terms of non-philosophy, the claim could be put this way. Given an object, more than one form of knowing is able to know it as such. For Laruelle, this effectively shatters what he sees as the underlying doxa, the faith of philosophical perception. The philosophical faith in philosophy's ability to think everything. This notion of doxa, or belief, or even faith, comes from Husserl, who says that he introduces the term, and I quote from Ideas, as suitably expressing the intentional back-reference of all modalities of belief which we previously have affirmed, unquote. In other words, doxa functions a great deal like an axiom, but with one fundamental difference. Its status as axiom is veiled, and so comes to function in an authoritarian way as simple fideistic faith, though without even realizing it could be even labeled as such. By recognizing and pointing out this doxa, this originary faith in philosophy, Laruelle is able to negate philosophy's authoritarianism in the true sense that philosophy takes itself as the authority on whatever is philosophizable, i.e. everything. And this negation leads to a new understanding of philosophy. So a non, or a no in French, non can be non in the English sense, it can also be no, in the sense, so a no essentially in the service of a yes. a no to philosophy in favor of the liberation of lived experience, vécu, that philosophy dominates. He writes, quote, exercising within the limits of phenomenal immanence, of being given or manifested, non-philosophy is a real thought. But we will outline an important nuance, in the last instance, or transcendental, which always means radically immanent. A thought according to real experience, which reduces objectivity itself rather than of possible experience. When it comes to thought, for the auto position of possible experience, non-philosophy substitutes the simple axiomatic but transcendental experience. The real or phenomenal experience can no longer be posed or thought other than through axioms and first names, rather than through concepts, categories, and philosophical theses. Okay, end quote. That comes again from Principles. Now, vécu, what she's referring to in that quote, is lived experience, is a notoriously difficult word to translate into English. Though most people simply go with lived experience. And this often makes sense since it is related, as many of you may know already, to the German Leibniz. Vécu, a very common term in Larwell's work, repeated throughout Principles especially, but many of his other works, even up to the most recent Anti-Bidou, which is just out as well, is the past participle of vivre, to live. But this has the sense also of living through something. So when you talk about to live in this sense, it also means to go through something. Now, past participles are very important in Larwell's various formulations. So I think it's helpful when we're talking about continental philosophy to sometimes stick with more familiar examples. So I like to think of a phenomenological example here. Hopefully phenomenology is a little bit familiar to people. Because Larwell often speaks of the given without givenness, the seen without sight. And so I have tended to translate vécu with the somewhat clumsy lived to make sense of his formulation vécu sans vie, or lived without life, with a capital L. In each case, where you have this sans, which, you know, for Derridians, they know that this is an important moment. In each case, the point is to free the actualized, immanent identity from its transcendental conception, always for Larwell, actually dependent and projected from that actualized identity. And this for Larwell is precisely what philosophy does. It claims to think some actual thing and ends up projecting and circumscribing these actuals in closed concepts within a transcendence, confusing one actual, the transcendent term, with another. In one of his more effusive moments, Larwell puts it this way: if philosophy has only been and only ever will be an opinion and a poorly thought out passion, then the question is a passing from its state of war and of competition, a state of exploitation of thought and as such of man, to its civil state, which we want to call human and democratic. In later works, he'll go on to modify these two terms, preferring humane and even referring to a kind of communism as equivalent to the democracy he advocates. So to continue the quote, this democratic humanization is one of the objectives, if there are any, of non-philosophy, and perhaps even the only objective. If we decided to put the real at the heart of man, or man at the heart of the real, rather than one at the periphery of the other, as philosophy itself does, end quote. Okay. So since this is a small enough group, and I've already alienated one person.
Oh, no, she had to go in.
No.
I was thinking, oh, no.
No. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page with this. So one of the important aspects of Larwell's work that he clues up with is grammar. And his writing is sometimes difficult because he intentionally is not very grammatical. It doesn't follow the normal conventions of grammar. But there's this grammatical cluing up to an important aspect of his philosophy where he always wants to free the immanent, the actualized, in this case the lived, from a transcendental conception. Life, a transcendental conception of sight, all those big concepts of philosophy. So his attempt is always going to be to think things like the transcendentals, the good, the true, the beautiful, from something that's actually lived as good, true, and beautiful, to take that example, or that would be in person the good. Okay, so this is the decision for radical immanence, to think from the radically immanent experience of the lived rather than from the concept. Okay. Now, this brief introduction to the contours of non-philosophy brings us to the real point of, you know, what this lecture is about today. However necessary an introduction may be for a figure like Larwell who isn't yet known. But the real point of this lecture, of course, is Larwell's ethical theory. And it, too, has to do with this question of the lived, rather than some transcendental or quasi-transcendental, like the good, the event, or even life as such. Each of these, Larwell claims, is ultimately a way of submitting the human and the lived of the human to philosophy, to thought. Each is, in a sense, a thought of the victor. And even more nefarious are those ethical philosophies that claim to be thinking, in some sense, for victims. Think about a recent popular article by Quentin Mayasu that attempts to create a speculative, materialist philosophy of hope built on his idea of radical contingency. Radical contingency meaning that the only absolute is contingency itself. This argument is put forward in an essay of his called Spectral Dilemma, published in the journal Collapse in English. In this essay, Mayasu creates a third way between what he sees as the pitfalls of atheism and theism, as both regard the problem of evil. With the first, atheism, there can be no possibility of justice for Mayasu. The dead are merely dead. With the second, theism, there is the clear problem of how evil can be allowed to exist by a good God. Mayasu's solution to the dilemma of the murdered dead is to posit hope in the God who may exist in the future. For the universe is such, in his philosophy, that its absolute contingency means that there is no sufficient reason that a God couldn't exist in the future, even if such a God does not exist now. That a God could come into existence and retroactively render justice for the dead. In some sense, what Mayasu is doing here, and this has captured the imagination of younger students who are interested in continental philosophy, especially interested in a way forward in continental philosophy of religion that would take seriously materialist and speculative strands of continental philosophy that are kind of growing in popularity today. But what we see here in Mayasu is really a rewriting of Leibniz's classic theodicy, that this is the best of all possible worlds. Mayasu's rewriting could be put this way, I think. This is not the best of all possible worlds, but there's no sufficient reason why in the future it could not become such. And it would be precisely because, in the same way that in Leibniz, this is the best of all possible worlds because God has arranged it such, in the future, a God may exist that would make this the best of all possible worlds. Now, it looks promising, this materialist Christian theodicy, because I think Quentin Mayasu ultimately does remain a Christian thinker, but it's still a ruse of philosophy's power from a non-philosophical perspective. For once again, it isn't the human that will come to be a messiah for the human, but we are to wait upon a God to come and render justice, some transcendence to come and establish utopia. Theodicy, I want to suggest to you, is always the purview of the hangman. If this is true, theodicy is never the thought for victims, the thought against evil, but the thought of the victors, of creating more and more victims in the name of some transcendence over humanity. In a recent book by Larwell, Théorie générale des victimes, Larwell's it's his 2012 work, he opens with this epigraph. If the hangman is the corner of society, as Joseph de Maistre says, why wouldn't the victim be the cornerstone of humanity? So if the hangman is the cornerstone of society, why wouldn't the victim be the cornerstone of humanity? The victim is anti-theodicy, the refusal of theodicy in flesh and blood. If I were to speculate on what Larawell's response would be to Mayasu's solution to his spectral dilemma, I would begin with Larawell's differentiation of the two atheisms that Larawell says exists. In the victim's book, he writes, and I quote, "The true atheism is not nearly as simple as philosophy imagines it. It goes through two stages. First, the banal refusal to believe in a God, which is self-contradictory and satisfies the small thinking. Then the refusal to believe in a good God, which is the true rebellion. There is always a God waiting in ambush who prepares his return in some negation, even if it is of his existence, making it materialist. But it is important that this is a bad God, a thesis only an ultra-religious heresy can approach. The atheism of indifference is weak and falls in rank with the speech of philosophy. The second is a strong heresy, the non-theological radicalization of the bad God." End quote. So I should say here, you know, Larawell does have this crazy Gnostic theology that he's been developing, which shows, you know, his complete lack of sort of concern for his career, because to write, you know, as a Gnostic is already, you're already putting yourself outside of what the Christian theologians are going to be okay with, because Christian theologians are constantly terrified that everyone else is a Gnostic, including the theologians they don't like, you know. And so just to say, like, out front, yep, I'm a Gnostic, you're out there. But also, even good atheist philosophers like Badiou are always talking about how, you know, we have to avoid Gnosticism and this sort of thing. So he's been working on this through about four different books, including Future Christ. And what he's saying here really is that theology has to be made, and this is a controversial statement, but for the human. All theory is ultimately for the human. And this is a difficult part of his thought, because what he means by the human isn't humanism. It's not like French, 18th century humanism, where what you're saying man is basically the white European man, and then you kind of go around the world trying to take that enlightenment to people who aren't white Europeans and say you should be like this, which has some bad aspects. I think even our most pro-enlightenment thinker might agree, you know. It's not that kind of humanism. What instead is it's a defense of the human that is not yet thought by philosophy. Because part of his big problem with philosophy is that it never actually gives attention to the human as such. It always reduces the human or subjugates the human by thinking it in relationship to something that the human isn't as such. Again, it's that as suchness. This is the Husserl Kant influence on him. So, for example, it'll think the human as rational animal. It'll think the human as essentially found in, like, the noble savage. It'll think that the human has to be overcome, and so it'll advocate, forget the human, it's all about the overman, it's all about the post-human. This is what philosophy is always looking at. It's never looking at the human. And so his big obsession is, okay, how do we actually think ordinary, the ordinary human, the ordinary man? And this is why he even turns to theology, because theology, for him, especially Gnostic Christian theology as such, it's always thinking about the essence of the human. What interests him about Christ is that Christ is the human. The historical Jesus, but also because he's essentially a thinker that, you know, the Messiah can come in many forms, but the Christ that this is Docetism, right? I'm remembering my heresies, right? Docetism, the idea that, you know, the Christ's essence on the cross was like a lie, it was just an appearance. He sort of thinks that for him, though, it's kind of the reverse, that Christ's true essence is his humanness, and that the divine aspect is just the appearance. That's what he's essentially arguing, is that thinking Christ ultimately gets you to thinking, in some sense, the essence, to use that philosophical word, of man. The generic aspect of the human. Okay, so he thinks God, and because God is, in some sense, the ultimate name for the transcendent notion, the transcendent concept that is projected, it's a good Feuerbachian, that is projected by the human, that then subjugates the human. Now, if we're going to think in ethics from the point of view that Larvelle wants, where it's not going to be about theodicy, where it's not going to be about trying to explain away why they're suffering, then it's going to have to be thought from the victim. It means rejecting the theodicy of both the atheist and the theist, to use Maeseau's terms. But in Larvelle's terms, what we're really doing is rejecting the theodicy of the materialist and the idealist while making use of the elements of their theodicies as materials in order to construct an ethic from the perspective of victims. So what this means is he wants to think from victims, from the experience of victimhood, in order to give a truly immanent ethical theory of victimhood. And to do that, we're still going to have to use the materials that we find in standard philosophies anyway. So the materials of the atheist, of the theist, of the materialist, of the idealist. But we're going to reject the notion that those materials are sufficient unto themselves. Now they're just going to be objects. They're just going to be materials in the sense of building materials, of things that human beings can work with. So ultimately, this refusal looks like this. This refusal takes the victim as the essence of humanity, that the experience of being a victim is in some sense revealing of what it means to be truly human. That the experience not of the victors, of those who are strong and those who succeed, those who can create a theodicy because it did work out for them, but actually from the perspective of the person who it doesn't work out for. The perspective where theodicy is nothing really but either a cheap joke or a cruel joke. Okay. Now, we can talk about this in more detail in the question and answer time if you guys want to, because this gets played out in rather technical ways through his theory of what he calls the victim in person, meaning that the notion of being a victim obviously is an add-on to this human essence he's talking about. But when one is a victim, and it's a truly imminent act of being a victim, it's in your person, it's in your flesh and blood. And so it's only when your victimhood is actualized, it's only when anyone's victimhood is actualized, that the term victim comes to mean anything in a non-philosophical ethics. We can talk about that in-person aspect because it gets very technical. We can also talk a little bit, for those who may have questions relating this to his discussion of justice and memory and future Christ, if that's something of interest. But I've basically set those aside because it's very technical and it tends to scare people off. Instead, what I want to do is take a look at the more concrete form that his ethics takes in a recent essay of his called Photo Fiction, A Non-Standard Aesthetics. Photo Fiction, A Non-Standard Aesthetics. And I guess I should plug it because it's my favorite small press now. You probably can't tell, but it's a really beautiful book published on Linen by this Minneapolis press. And it's in a bilingual edition, and it's a sequel to his work called The Concept of Non-Photography. Now, I'm going to say again that this is a more obviously concrete practice that he focuses on in Photo Fiction, because what he's focusing on is the concrete practice of photography. Now, I say obviously concrete because I'm going to resist the notion that philosophy isn't in itself a practice, that there isn't something of a practice in delivering this paper to you today, or there isn't something of a practice in the way I sit at my computer or iPad and construct each sentence that I'm going, when I was writing this, that I was thinking of giving you today. There's a practice there. So I don't want to get in this silly thing where somehow thought isn't practice. But there is something more concrete, maybe, in more obviously concrete in photography. And more importantly, in this book, the practice of photojournalism is examined by Larvelle. In photojournalism, the questions of aesthetics and politics, the question of ethics, come together, and they seem intractable from one another. And we can all bring to mind a number of important photographs in the history of our culture that have had important ethical impacts, that have had political impacts. So a child running burned from the napalm of American bombs, a black African child starving while a vulture sits seemingly waiting for it to die, an Afghani woman or girl, cool and wise, kind of staring at us, captured once when she was a child, and once again as an adult, having experienced two imperial invasions, the Soviet and then American ones. And of course, there are photos of quote-unquote objects, like the grainy shots of the Twin Towers burning, or the blue marble floating in space, solitary, unprotected by any god, which ends up being our home. Each photo could be thought to capture some event, to be an icon of the event, pointing away from itself to the event. But this would be the trap. This notion of thinking the photo in that way would be a trap, according to Laurie Will. For the event, to use a Bedouin term, like all philosophical projections of transcendence, even if it is a Maoist transcendence, is actually an idol as well. I'm thinking here of Jean-Luc Marion's analysis of the difference between the icon and the idol, which essentially claims that the icon points beyond itself, beyond its being and presence, to the God who is exousia, without or beyond being. While the icon captures and captivates the human gaze in itself, in its presence, and its being. While the idol captures and captivates the gaze in itself, in its presence, and its being. Now, of course, all of this depends in some sense on accepting the version of God present in Marion's Catholic phenomenology, a version of God who, it ends up at the end of God without being, and this is, so you read that whole book and you think, this guy's pretty rebellious, and then at the end, it turns out that only the bishops can actually speak about God. You're like, oh, okay. Now, the point of this quasi-theology is something that I've called in other places a weaponized apophaticism, where the turning of something seemingly radical, the absolute transcendence of God, is turned into a tool of a worldly authority, a tool of a victor over the victims of religion, such that the gaze directed beyond the presence of whatever is called the icon ends up being directed nefariously to some worldly authority, ends up being captured by some worldly authority. In the case of Marion, I think that's the Roman Catholic Church, the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church, not the individual acts of people, but the hierarchy. But it could just as well be anything. It could be the university, it could be the Ayatollah, it could be the authority of civil religion in America, all these sorts of things. Hence, the idolatry present in the weaponized icon is exactly an example of the subjugation of the human to some transcendence. Instead, consider how the image of the photo, just an image, neither an icon nor an idol, is described by Laura Well. The photo creates the event and is itself nothing but an event, from whence we get the risk of the vicious cycle that is the element of journalism. Now, journalism is said to be a vicious cycle because it ultimately is, in a similar way to philosophy, self-sufficient, about itself. One must create a story in order to sell the papers. An image is created not for the sake of a people, but for the sake of moving units. This isn't how the photo has to be, and ultimately, one of the reasons powerful works of photojournalism subsist in our memory has to do with the fact that there is something also generic about these photos. Laura Well describes this generic nature this way, and I quote, "The generic photo is ethically people-oriented, in service of their defense, and passes from the positive photo devoted to the world's narcissism to the generic photo, which is not that of subjects, but rather of objects. The generic photo is a practical difference forbidding the infinite aspects from communicating or switching with finite aspects that make up humanity," end quote. Okay. So what can an ethical theory, what can an ethical philosophy do when confronted with these kinds of photos? Well, according to Larwell, first it should be combined with the photo. This is the meaning of the notion of photo fiction, the title of his book. He uses this kind of formulation all the time. Photo fiction, philo fiction, art fiction. This is basically his new name for philosophy, in some sense. It's creating these fictions. And what he means by this photo fiction is a superposition of two variables into a single new wave of thought, a new practice. So it isn't about constructing the principles for the photo, which would be like a philosophy of the photo, or about simply commenting on the history of the photo, a kind of fan fiction of the photo, but combines this philosophical practice of thinking conditions and the thing in itself with the photos themselves. So in other words, it's an attempt to think, how can a philosopher think something like photography and not overdetermine it? How can it actually think the thing without just doing what philosophy normally does in these situations, where you know, it comes along and it says, oh, this thing is neat. You know, it looks a lot like what Aristotle said. So I'm going to write a chapter on Aristotle, and then I'm going to write a chapter on this thing, and then I guess I have an article, you know. Instead, for him, it's going to be, how can we think the photo in a way that is philosophical, where the photo itself becomes a philosophical practice? Okay, no problem. Okay, so Larwell says that it's a way of taking ontological care of being in its entirety in order to be surprised by it. And for example, to be surprised that there are victims, as if victims were being. The photo is the way in which the world astonishes itself, whereas it should be that in which man becomes indignant. So he's referencing the Spanish occupiers here, actually. So the photo, in the vicious circle of photojournalism, where it's about selling papers, is the way that the world shocks itself. But it should be the way that the human becomes indignant at the world. Photo fiction would rather be a way of taking pity on the photo fiction would be a way to take pity on the human rather than astonishing the world. The poor world that does not quit making war with itself via interposed photograph or modern war reporting, end quote. He goes on to write, unleash the photograph would like to pass into existence but remains decidedly a flat larva. Photo fiction is the decline of the ontological proof and auto-affirmation, the collapse of metaphysical mechanisms by which essences passed into existence within divine understanding. Shattered by the actuality of existence, modernity will need to come up for some air, will need the possible, just a photo to parody Godard, end quote. Now you'll notice in that little quote he references the ontological argument. And what does that mean? Well, why is that old theological trope here in a discussion of photojournalism and ethics? Well, it goes to the heart of how photography, the practice of capturing an image of the victim, remember always, in some sense, a subject, not the hidden and inalienable identity of the human that is expressed by this image. And it goes to that heart because the ontological argument begins in history as a theological argument and ends as another way of subjecting the human to something other than the human in Descartes. I mean, the ontological argument's essentially repeated in the cogito as the grounding of the human subject. The ontological argument famously posits proof for the existence of God rooted in nothing other than the definition, the thought of God and God's self. God exists because the definition of God is the highest within thought, presumes existence for a perfect thing, is less perfect if it does not exist. So, essentially, God exists because the definition of God means that God is the highest within thought. You can't think of something that's high, that's good, that's true in thought, that doesn't have existence, insofar as it's better to have a pizza in front of you than to not have a pizza in front of you. Ergo, in some sense, ergo, God exists. Now, I mean, obviously, people have argued over whether or not this works as a proof. I'm not entirely sure anyone's ever converted to anything because of it. And philosophers like Kant have tried to disprove this. Kant did with his famous 100 Thalers example, where, you know, I can think of $100 in my pocket, but it doesn't make it there. Now, that's obviously become more difficult in an age of financial capital where money, the existence of money, isn't rooted in its physical existence. But regardless, if it is God or money, or if these are the same thing, they are rooted only in the thought of themselves, in the theory of them. Self-sufficient, narcissistic, all-encompassing and circular. In the terms of power politics, this is strength, self-reliance, victor. Consider, though, again, the way justice works in a circular way. The victim becomes the prosecutor at trial. literally persecuting the body of the criminal in the way they had been persecuted prior. There is an element of reversibility between the criminal and the victim that implies the potential, all too present in our world, of a vicious circle of violence. A vicious circle that can only be overturned by moving away from the terms of victors to simply one of the victims. A demand for a different world to be created to serve the creatures that inhabit it, rather than what the creatures must bend their lives to. A world that is submitted, as Orwell says, to bodies, the unilateral nature of the radical victim, without reversibility brought about by this notion of justice. He says, and I'll end here, the photograph is the art of revival, of a weak resurrection, but reduced to insurrection, unquote. Indeed, this insurrection of bodies is what a non-philosophical ethics aspires to. Okay. Thank you.
So we've got time for questions. Has anybody got a question they'd like to start off with? Dwayne.
Could I just, thanks for that. Could I just explore a little bit about the photograph? I was thinking when you were talking about that in terms of eisegesis and exegesis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and but I get a sense that where is the photographer in this and what are they up to? Because the photographer might be literally like a philosopher, in the sense that, you know, if you take a photograph, you know, thinking of journalism, you know, they want you to read into something, read something into it, and they're reading something into it. So if they take a picture of a newt, they want you to see a crocodile, or want you to see a dragon, and so on. Because there's an embellishment going on. So can it be a kind of, can there really be an exegesis at all in the photograph and kind of its relation to the world? I guess if that makes sense.
Yeah. So I mean, is it kind of a question about if the intention of the artist matters? Is that sort of?
I guess it's that, but I'm just wondering the place of the photograph in relation to the photographer.
Of the photographer, okay, yeah, okay, yeah, I understand.
In relation to what your example of the photograph in relation to philosophy.
Yeah. Well, so for Larwell, it sort of relates back to his theory of subjectivity, which I didn't touch on. But for Larwell, his theory of the subject is. Basically, that there's this radical immanent essence, if you will, of the human that all of you are. He uses the term the real, which is kind of a popular French philosophical term. To mean all sorts of stuff, but usually people think it's Lacan, but it's in Bergson, it's in more sane people than Lacan, you know, that sort of thing. But what he means by the real is this, the human, you know, this inalienable clandestine core that I don't have access to, that you don't have access to. And trying to think that is his big obsession. Subjects are essentially appearances that people take on. so it's not that they're not real, but that they're ultimately dependent and only relatively autonomous in relationship to the radical autonomy of this clandestine, inalienable core essence, whatever. So a subject is always a kind of projection from this thing that the subject then doesn't touch. And so theoretically, the philosopher is also just a subject. So he uses the term, in Future Christ, for example, when he's talking about the messianic character that subjects can take on, he says Christ subject. He also uses the term philosopher subject. In relationship to art, he talks about this as he actually calls them clones, not just projections, but it's a projection in some sense of the artist. So when a photographer is taking a photo, they're sort of projecting this subject that can be located in all the normal ways that we locate subjects, signifiers, all that sort of thing. But it's always built off of this thing that is in some sense common to everyone else, this clandestine thing. So that gives him in some sense license to say this kind of common thing, not just found in Orwell, but this gives him license to make the claim that when a philosopher comes along and does photo fiction, or a photographer comes along and does the same thing in a different medium, like photography, that it's not about the originary subject who created it. It doesn't have to be about that. But when the originary subject created it, that's also one potential identity that could have been formed. But when other subjects come into contact with it, it becomes a kind of fractalized. It comes off into new readings of it. So,
Gadamer,
what's that?
Like Gadamer's thinking in terms of.
It might be. I mean, if you're seeing connections there, I'm sure they're probably there. But he's really. I wouldn't say he's a relativist in some kind of easily recognizable Anglophone sense. He's really a pluralist, though. It's an attempt to try to create a pluralizing effect in thought, while still having this commonality that connects those pluralizing things. So, yeah. Does that make sense, though? Does that get at it?
I'll ponder it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult.
Do we have any other questions?
Okay, I'm being really slow here, so I apologize for this question completely. But aren't victims, aren't their being victims logically dependent on their being victors? What I'm struggling with is that, so the Maesu stuff, you said, look, Maesu wants justice, but you can only get justice by having this sort of invoking something transcendent that comes to subject the human, and you're not thinking the human through itself. And in a sense, it sounded like you were thinking of this empowerment of the human in a way, but I realize that that's going to be complicated by what you said later. And then the response to that is to, in a sense, essentialize the human as victim. And to what extent is that a helpful move, to think of us always in a state of radical subjection? It's to think of, it's a Christian anthropology without God, in a way. That this idea, this lordship that we have over us. So we're always a slave, but there's just no longer a lord anymore to enslave us. Am I misunderstanding this completely?
No. Okay, so I mean, I think it's actually a good question. I mean, the first one, is it logic? Can there be victims without victors? No, I don't think that's his claim when he's saying you have to think from victims. He's also okay. No, the reason being that it's not a claim about getting rid of victors and saying no one's a victor. It's not a claim about getting rid of the strong. What he's trying to do when he makes it, because he doesn't just do this with victims, he does it with lots of stuff. So the lived, thinking, don't think the lived in relationship to life, think the lived unilaterally, so directly from the lived. And what he means by it is he wants to break out of dialectical thinking. So his big enemy is sort of this Hegelian tradition, which is why he writes this book Anti-Badu, because he sees in Badu a reinscription of this dialectical way of thinking. In some sense, he's against sort of certain strains of Marxism, like state Marxism, the way dialectics was encouraged in the Soviet system. And so what he's trying to get at is cutting off the victor from our thinking about the human. So we would think the victim as having something that actually tells us about the human, whereas the victor only tells us something about this clandestine core about the human, whereas the victor... but where the victor is ultimately that transcendental projection in some sense. Now, whether or not... So, does that mean, though, that victims are... the essence of humanity? That's a good question, and it makes me want to go back to the books and work that out a bit more. I think in his recent book, what he's getting at isn't that it's about the essence, but that in the same way that the hangman reveals something about society in Joseph de Maistre, so the hangman kind of hangs society together, there's something about a response to victimhood and the common experience of victimhood, suffering, the common experience of suffering. We could have used this term because one doesn't have to be a victim just to human beings. In some sense, one can just be a victim to the stupidity of the world. You know, the fact that I have... So I suffer from gout, and I get gout from eating spinach. That's stupid. Like, there's no reason why that is. And from all the other things that organize our world, you know, spinach should make me healthier, it should be good for me, and instead it's the opposite. And in some sense, I'm suffering from that. I mean, obviously that's a small example, but it's a stupidity can also be something that causes this experience of victimhood or suffering. And what he thinks is that it shows us something about the human, and it should be the essence or the cornerstone of an ethics, rather than thinking about covering over that. I mean, he's really against theodicy. He's really against this notion that he's very Jobian in this way. So I'd actually say it's more of a Jewish anthropology than a Christian necessarily, because the point is that you can't really have a response to the suffering in a way that's going to be adequate, that doesn't need to be constantly fractalized or proliferated.
Can I just say two more quick things? What I would love to know here is it sounds like it could be some kind of this an ethics of suffering, a valorization of suffering. Yeah. And that doesn't strike me as a good way to go for an ethics. That sounds something like the worst excesses of sort of Sarah Coakley and Graham Ward or something like that. And the other thing to say is that your point about it's meant to be sort of cognate with the lived without life or something like that. That seems to be good, but obviously it doesn't sound very structurally similar. The victim without the victor is X without not X. The lived without life is a victim without victimhood. It seems to be something more not something like that.
Okay, that's good too. Okay. So the first, there were two there. What was the first one?
The first one was just the point about kind of ethics of suffering and that. Okay.
And then, okay. All right, yeah. Okay, so the second one, it's only victim without victors because you're right, it doesn't totally match on to life, the live without life or the seen without sight or all those other formulations in his earlier work. But the idea is that it breaks the reversibility, because he writes in a couple different books on justice, where what kind of disturbs him, and this, you know, doesn't make him very popular in Western society. I think this, you know, he wouldn't be a very good law and order political candidate or something. But what disturbs him about the justice system is the reversibility between the victim and the criminal, where you can constantly reinscribe the victim and persecute a person, you know. So I've been doing a lot of work in my other life as a religion professor on Black American religion, and having read a lot about prisons, and I kind of get that. Like, there's something really disturbing about the way the legal system creates victims when it's supposed to be rendering justice, you know. And philosophically, I think maybe as a culture, we've done a bad job of thinking what justice might actually mean. Okay. So my response to that is basically like, yeah, but it's about the reversibility. Mm-hmm. So I maybe need to emphasize that more in the paper. The other one is just an ethics of suffering. I think it's totally different insofar as what he's trying to get at is he may fail. Like, that's the thing I do love about Larwell is all the time, even he's been working on this, you know, quantum physics thing, and he has physicist friends, so he's not completely out there on his own, but he knows that whenever someone talks about quantum physics, they can sound a little crazy. And he's like, I'm not actually sure yet if this works. You're seeing the work in progress. I have no idea if it works yet. right now I believe it does, and I'm going to see if it's valid. And I really like that about him. He's not, unlike, you know, like a, to stick with French people, like a figure like Badiou, he's much more open to the possibility of failure in his work. So it's totally possible that this totally fails. But I think what I like about this is this emphasis on the insurrectional element, this emphasis that it's not about staying a victim. It's about, just like when you're Christ subject and future Christ, that this appearance of Christliness or the messianic, it's not the truth of what you are, but it's always about moving, creating, changing something. And so in the photo fiction essay, the victims constantly make people angry. And that's the point of it. It's not about setting up a refusal to end suffering, to use that churchly term. It's not about a refusal to see suffering, but it's about being mad. It's about anger. So I don't quite think it ends up just valorizing suffering as such, but it does say to those real examples of suffering in the world where victims don't just stay there. Victims always respond. Not always, but victims often respond in creative ways. They deal with things. That's what he's valorizing, is the response of victims.
Simon.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting.
Thanks.
I've really also related very strongly to your experience of reading Marion.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
I was really interested in, I think it was kind of more the passing comment. I was making a lot of notes, but talking about the photograph of the victim, and you mentioned the Twin Towers, but this idea of the victim as object, not necessarily the victim as person, that, as, of course, as object can't speak for itself.
Yeah.
What would there be a sort of account of that through Laruelle?
Yeah, I think actually you're hearing something I said, and then a quote later on where he explicitly says that victims are objects in the photographs, not subjects. He also uses the term beings in like, you know, sarcastic quote marks. And yeah, what explicitly he's trying to account for is the human is never just a subject. So this kind of philosophical issue of the subject and the object he's really obsessed with it throughout his career, and he plays around with it in various ways, which creates interesting lines with other thinkers like Adorno and that sort of thing. But what he basically is thinking is that when a victim is photographed, they now are appearing as an object. That's not something he thinks is wrong. That's not something he's rejecting. That has a place, but it only has a place because both the subject and object are dependent or determined by that X. Like that he hasn't yet figured out how to describe yet, this human essence or generic human, or he uses a bunch of different terms through the 40 years of writing. Because both the subject and the object are in some sense coming out of that X. So he's not like an anti-objectifying guy, just like he's not an anti-subject guy that you sometimes get. Both of them are just sort of materials. They're concepts, they're ideas, that sort of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's very helpful, and it's a really useful sort of critique, partially of the Odyssey and of war, photo and journalism itself. But in a sense, by contemplating these images, we, in some senses, pity ourselves and pity the world that we've created rather than the victim itself.
Yeah.
But might there be a place for, for an image of an object which is a victim, there's no question of its subjectivity, in which it is only, in inverted commas, it is only a sort of almost a sort of object for our
a consumption.
Contemplation,
yeah.
A sort of mediation of self pity and anger or something.
Right, yeah, and I think he would want to say that's bad, but I think if I understand, yeah. So in this other book that. It's an interview book called, well, it doesn't have an English title yet. I'm trying to convince them to go with Last Chance. So it's, excuse my bad French accent, but L'ultime honneur, which is sort of like the ultimate honor, but it can also mean like the last chance of something. And he's playing on this double meaning of like the highest honor for intellectuals, but also the last chance for intellectuals is to think the victim, to think ethics, that sort of thing. So he's talking about these media-friendly intellectuals in there, and the way like BHL, Bernard-Henri Lévy, turns into for his own kind of project victims, you know. So he starts talking about the Libyans in ways where it ends up kind of being about BHL. It ends up about being about the French ideals rather than about the actual victims of whatever. So absolutely, you can make the victims consumable in a way. The goal is to make them human, and you can't consume them. And they're not something that you can sell, you can alienate. Because this is a very controversial claim Marwell makes, and it's his life's work to try to substantiate it, is that there is something inalienable about being human that can't be touched. Even when, like the Gnostics, they're all wiped off the face of the planet. He thinks that they're still resisting their murderers.
So just as not to press it too far, I mean, what about a non-human victim?
I was just going to ask that. Yeah. No, I mean, just I was wondering about that as well, because he has got this enormous emphasis. I don't know his work very well, but from what you're saying, he's focusing on the human. There's this kind of clandestine, imminent essence, if you like. But I was thinking, how does it? I wasn't sure how to make sense of this emphasis on human being, humanness, and then maybe an object could be a victim. Because what I was thinking of, well, could an animal be a victim? What could Larrewell say about that? And does he have any comments about, you know, animality and animal victims? Yeah. Would he be able to address that?
Okay, so here's where Larrewell and I tend to part company a bit. So, I guess I want to say that even though I'm writing this book on Larrewell, in part because I was asked to by people, like they wanted help understanding what the hell's going on in his work, and I spent a lot of time with it, and so I thought this would be a good project for me. But I was attracted to Larrewell precisely because I saw a method there in combining science and philosophy and theology and philosophy that I found really freeing. For the way I had been trained as an undergraduate in the history of philosophy, where, you know, I would kind of write, and these are valuable, so I'm not denigrating it, but where you would write commentaries on things. And I was very interested in combining philosophy and ecology to think the issue of nature. And so even though I've somehow now become his emissary, you know, I don't want to always be his emissary. So I want to say that. But in my dissertation, where I use him as a method, I disagree with him very strongly on this, because he does emphasize the human a great deal. And he's been pushed by lots of people, but including myself and John Malarkey in English, to talk more about animals. And he does a little bit in this victim's book. It's the first time he's ever talked about animals that we know of. And he does it in a way that's actually not too bad. It still ends up pretty conservative. But he basically says that, and he's continuing to work on this in some new books, where he's trying to think the animal man with his little hyphen, where it'd be a superposition of these two things. So the animal and the human still have autonomy, but then they're thought together in some way that also has validity and substance. And so that's his new project. But his normal position is still pretty, for me, is a vegetarian, quasi-vegan. I'm still a little bit actually suspicious of, but it fits in line with most ethical meat eaters. So he basically thinks that suffering should be alleviated as much as possible with animals, and that they do in fact suffer. This is a project his wife is working on with some geneticists in France, actually, is the issue of animal suffering. So he's been very interested in it, but it's only in his very recent work in the last 2 years that he's really started to think about it. So the animal can be a victim, he says, but only because the human is a victim and ascribes victimhood to the animal, which I'm a little bit, I don't agree with, but I, yeah.
Because Because that sounds like he's recreating another sovereign of some sort, and mainly.
That's the worry, yeah. That's my worry.
Can I just ask another question? Sorry. Okay, It's just I'm really not familiar with Lara Wells' work, and I don't know. I think it's probably quite obvious, but I'm just missing it. But the non philosophy bit, this idea that philosophy has these outsides. I'm not quite sure how this what you've been saying about victims exemplifies this approach, that his method, because it doesn't. Particularly like Dan's point about the victimhood as a essence. Potentially, mm-hmm. That might be what he's saying. Mm-hmm. That seems to be like a classic kind of philosophical move. You're looking forward to, well, this thinking through, because you use that kind of expression, yeah. Thinking through something that's actual, but actually in doing that you're making it strangely abstract. I'm trying to work out, how does this concept of victim and how it might make us rethink about humanness, humanity even. How does that kind of work in this non-philosophy? Because I would have thought he would have been more, the photojournalism maybe, mm-hmm. but actually, you know, I don't know if this is what non-philosophy is, but going in and working with people who are actually dealing with actual victims and hearing their stories and voices. And yeah. I don't know, is that what he's wanting to...
Okay, so there's actually like three questions in there. But I'm going to try to... No, I like that. I'm good at that.
Running out of time.
I just want to try to touch on those, because they're all very good. So I heard one that's basically like, does he make the victim an essence? And I want to strongly emphasize, no, it's just an occasion for his thought in this example. So, you know, sometimes it is... sometimes the occasion for his thinking is... it's like Christ, you know, who isn't just a victim. Sometimes the occasion for his thinking is whatever science he's into. So for a long time it was fractal geometry, you know, it's quantum mechanics. So there are occasions, and some occasions are privileged in his work over others. Victimhood is one. He thinks it's a privileged mode of access to thinking about the generic level of humanness that he really wants to get to. It does make it very abstract. But for him, abstraction does not necessarily mean that it isn't actualized. So for him, the abstract, it's kind of an Adorno point as well. The abstract comes to take on a life, a lived notion, because it's thought, it's you know, it's human creation. And there's often a question people have with this non-philosophy thing, because it sounds like what he's saying is stop doing philosophy in the normal mode of doing philosophy, where you write another damn philosophy book, right? And so if you're going to be concerned about victims, you should go do things with victims. You should go, in some sense he means is everyone, but you should go, you know, volunteer, do that sort of stuff, or make art, bring awareness. And a lot of times, I just spoke to art students yesterday, and they were asking about this as well, because it's non-aesthetics, it's pretty similar. And my response to that is, absolutely, he's not saying you shouldn't. Larwell isn't the world. You know, Larwell isn't the master. And his point isn't to just do what he does. You can go and do this sort of notion in completely different ways. You can do this sort of project in completely different ways. You can do it without writing a book, but this is still a medium that's important. Teaching, doing lectures are still mediums that are important. That doesn't denigrate the importance of going and copying down victim stories and presenting them. Doesn't negate the importance of creating art. That is also a thing that should be done, because the human is that proliferation, that kind of perversity of creation.
Okay.
Yeah.
I should
ponder.
We are running out. I've actually hogged the last few minutes. Can you believe that? But I would like us to show our appreciation for the talk by Anthony Wolfman. So if we can just... Thank you. Thank you very much, Anthony. And if anyone didn't get their question in, I'm sure they can nap you now. So thank you very much. And thank you, the audience.